Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I'm Yada. Each weekday here on GCN, we strive to expose the destructive myths which are associated with religion and politics, patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission on this program is to understand what is actually occurring behind the headlines while predicting how these events will shape our world. Then during our second hour, we're going to engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since His is the lone reliable and credible voice in an exceedingly disingenuous world. Our phone number over the next 2 hours, if you'd like to participate in this discussion or question or criticize anything that is said by your host, is 877-300-7645. You know, it strikes me that for Christian Mingle to be able to run as many ads as they do throughout the media, they evidently must recognize that Christians are stupid, that they're ignorant and irrational. For someone to believe that you get blessings from God by participating in a business, that God is using a computer to match like-minded people in a religion that he personally has no involvement in whatsoever, that's your sign. Wear it proudly. It says that you are stupid, particularly if you're one of the millions of Christians who actually participate in it. It says, yep, I am absolutely ignorant. I am clueless as to who God is, what He wants, what He does, how He engages in lives, how to participate in a relationship with Him, how to be saved by Him. And if I have a clue, then I'm ignorant because I cannot process that information rationally. Speaking of irrational, I just don't understand. Why is it that when someone gets killed, that they become an American hero? What is heroic about dying? Now, if you're dying and you got killed because there was a way for you to intervene and substitute your life for someone else's life, well, that's one thing. I can see that you could be considered a hero for having sacrificed your life to save the life, say, of a child that would be otherwise run over in the street. But firefighters, heroic because they got scorched? I mean, it's sad. But think about the kind of negligence that is involved for 19 firefighters as part of a crew battling a blaze in very sparsely forested area. No large trees here in the area where they were scorched. It was the land around them was scorched. It was just kind of low, deserty kind of brush. You know, all of these men ought to have been wearing GPS locator devices that not only told them exactly where they were, but also those supervising them where they were. It would be extraordinarily easy. While it might be difficult to have a plane down low when the winds pick up, and it might put pilots in jeopardy to have planes down low throwing retardant on a fire unless human life was at risk, you would risk a plane to drop retardant on the area around a fire crew if the fire crew was in jeopardy. But you could certainly have an aircraft circling high above, not subject to being buffered by those the updrafts and downdrafts of mountain area winds, keeping not only appraised of exactly where they were relative to the fire, but also being able to tell them well in advance, hey, you need to move in this direction to this place and hunker down now because the fire has changed and is moving in this direction. And then when it looks like there is a real high risk of injury, to be able to call in a very specific to a GPS coordinate drop of water or retardant around those individuals. Easily could have saved their lives with existing technology and just using one's brain. But no, we have a tendency to exonerate those who are in leadership positions by worshiping those who have been killed by calling them heroes. Now, I'm sorry, it is a shame that those men died, and many of them were fathers and sons, and they were all either fathers or sons, and they had families who deeply loved them, and it is a tragedy that they're gone. And I am not an expert in firefighting, but I can tell you, based upon the technology and using aircrafts, that it would have been much easier to save them than it is to glorify them now that they are dead. I want to talk about another story. This might not be among the top stories in the nation today. It was over the weekend. But the Asiana Airlines Boeing 777 that crashed in San Francisco. For those who may have seen it, the airplane came in low. It was slow. The pilot pulled up the nose of the aircraft, which essentially stalled it. He struck the landing gear and the tail of the aircraft on the rocks 1,000 feet before the runway threshold. The airplane careened going down the runway, losing its tail, shattering the pressure vessel in the rear of the aircraft, doing a cartwheel, losing its right engine, and then coming to rest at the 1,500-foot mark of the runway, which is about where it should have touched down. There's a lot of issues related to that crash that are worth considering. By way of background, while I'm not part of, obviously, the investigation team, I am a ATP, the highest certificate one can hold when flying airplanes is an ATP. The crewman on that airplane held ATP certificates, airline transport pilot certificates. I am type rated in jets, know a fair amount about their operation. Well, all of the facts are not in, although they are all known. This was pilot error. But it was a judgment error that is far greater than just pilot error. When you hear we have not ruled out anything, let's be honest, was pilot error. The man that was flying the airplane at the time had 44 hours in type. That means that this was the third leg. If he went to sim school for this particular aircraft, then this may have been the first time that he was sitting in the left seat. It may have been his first actual landing if the other hours were in a simulator. That's right. The man who crashed the airplane had 44 hours in type in a 777. It's not known for certain, but it is assumed that the first officer of the aircraft was mentoring him, was training him on how to fly the airplane, an airplane with 300 souls on board. Talk about arrogance, risking lives in that way. And what's amazing, too, is that the senior pilot, who had thousands of hours in type, didn't intervene when it was obvious that there was a serious problem. Another aspect of this particular crash that bears reporting is that the ILS, the instrument landing system, the glide slope was out. Now, it was published that it was going to be out. They knew it was going to be out before they took off from Shanghai. So they had 12 hours to prepare for the fact that it was going to be out. It was out for routine maintenance. They were given a visual approach. They were given a visual approach using the same vectors that they would have been given for an instrument, the ILS approach. It was perfectly clear, 10 miles visibility, no clouds, light winds, 8 knots. And so a visual approach is something that every pilot ought to be able to do. In fact, you ought not have to use the instrument landing system, the ILS, unless the conditions are ceilings very low, you know, somewhere between 200 and 1,000 feet, and the visibility is quite low in terms of fractions of a mile. But it is a reality today that airlines want pilots to fly, to use all of the automation, which is to fly the airplane on autopilot all the way through the process, including landing. Which means if you input improper data, that could be tragic. And if the instrumentation fails because you're not trained to fly the airplane by hand visually, tragedies occur. And that's what happened here. There were so many indications that this approach was doomed. It is stunning that that what we heard from the investigators was that 7 seconds before the plane crashed, someone in the cockpit said, "I need more speed." He didn't need more speed. He needed more power. Speed can be achieved by pointing the nose down. But when you're at 200 feet above the ground, you don't want to point the nose down. Part of this, too, is this the decision by the U.S. government, the FAA, that everyone should fly every approach the same way. We fly instrument approaches on a 3% gradient. You should look at a 3% gradient. It'll draw a line on a piece of paper along the long side of an 8.5 by 11 piece of paper on a 3% gradient and see that you're not even a half an inch above the edge of the paper 11 inches away. Very shallow. Gives you no room should something go wrong. There are airspeed references that are used for landings in jets. This one was 137 knots. This airplane probably stalls around mid-80s in terms of stall speed. This crew was very close to stall speed. In fact, got the stick shaker about 4 seconds before crash. When you get a stick shaker in an airplane like this, that means the yoke begins to shake and said you're within 10% of stalling speed of the aircraft, and yet they continue to pull up the nose. A pusher shaker would actually push the nose down, but a stick shaker just tells the pilot you're within moments of crashing. They did not add power at that time. The pilot did not ask for a go-around until 1.5 seconds from the time that the plane impacted the runway. On a jet engine, it takes 5 seconds to spool up from idle to 95% power. Jets, unlike props, are very slow to respond, and so you have to be thinking ahead of the aircraft. But here, we have become a society that is so reliant on technology. People just don't know how to act when that technology isn't there to serve them. I mean, try to get someone today, rather than communicating via text on their cell phones or on their tablets or by email on their computer, to handwrite you a note. Say in cursive and see what happens. It's the same thing. We become dependent on our technology. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about the Asiana Airlines Boeing 777 crash in San Francisco. The owner of the, not the air owner, but the CEO of the airline has already said that the airplane did not suffer from any mechanical or engine-related failure, which means that the only justification for explaining how the airplane was below the glide slope, initially above it, then below the glide slope and slow, and then initiated a go-around, which means we can't make this approach. We need to add power, bring up the flaps, the landing gear, climb on runway heading to 1,000 feet AGL, which would have been 1,000 feet MSL also at this particular airport, and then fly the designated missed approach, that they made that decision 1.5 seconds before impact. Yeah, is pilot error. And we learned that the pilot flying the aircraft had 44 hours in type and was learning. One of the things that struck me, too, is the praise that is now heaped on first responders. First responders are given now, like military soldiers, are given heroic status. They're being presented now in society as that they are the, you know, this is the darling of society. These are the best of us. They are worthy of just great praise. Well, without admitting it, it has now been acknowledged, and they didn't have the character to admit it, but it is now being acknowledged that one of the youngest victim in this particular crash, or two that have died, the youngest of the two, the child that died, did not die in the crash. She was run over by one of the first responders. Now, I understand accidents happen, but if that being the case, why not disclose it? Another woman was crushed inside of the airplane because the impact was so severe on the tail that the inflatable slide that normally opens outside the aircraft actually opened inside of the aircraft. And because of Islamic terrorists, knives are no longer allowed inside of an aircraft. Now, with a knife, there is no longer anything that you could do to hijack an airplane. You could have gun, dynamite, you could have all manner of things inside of that airplane. Yeah, you could have an AK-47 inside of an airplane, and you can't hijack it anymore. And all they had to do, and they have done it, is cover the door to the cockpit with Kevlar, and then to reinforce the locks such that there is no way to force your way into the cabin of an aircraft. It cannot be hijacked, no matter what you have in the back. But we still have a government that likes to control everything we do, so there are no knives. So when this slide ballooned up inside of the aircraft and the woman was trapped on the ceiling and being crushed, there was no way to deflate the slide. There was no way to get her out of the burning aircraft because there was no sharp object in the cabin. There is a another issue related to this particular crash that is indeed troubling. The media reporting. Most everything the media has reported has been a mix of about 80%. They got the information wrong and it was right before their eyes, or with 20% being right. A mix of 80-20, truth to untruth. Any time that and all of you who are listening to this program have expertise in one subject or another, any time you listen to or read media reporting on a subject that you have an expertise in, what you find is that the media is providing misinformation more often than they are accurate information, and that has been the case in this reporting from the beginning. It is extraordinarily troubling that the source of information is provided by people who have no actual expertise. Even when CNN brings in their experts, most of their initial experts were absolutely talking through their behind. They had no, they pretended to be experts, and almost everything they said was untrue. It isn't that hard to have people who are more than just talking heads deliver the news. You know, your news reporters could actually be journalists. What a novel idea. Just because they don't have the prettiest little noses and the cutest faces and the nicest hair doesn't mean they wouldn't be better than those who are now delivering the news. When we return to Shattering Myths, we're going to transition to what's taking place in Egypt and the American response to it. We hinted at this briefly on Friday, but there is an enormous disconnect between Barack Hussein Obama and what has happened in Egypt that we need to explore. It is a tragedy that America is not holding him accountable. We'll return to Shattering Myths in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. Okay, I lied. I told you we were going to go directly to the story in Egypt and how the Barack Hussein Obama administration is handling it. But a friend of mine just sent me a story which is hard to imagine. My personal withdrawal from ordinary life, when I want a breather from all of the issues of life, I watch sports. That's Scott, my producer, and I talk sports during the commercials very often in the program. It's kind of just a way to withdraw. Some people drink, some people go do risky things, race cars or something. I watch sports or play sports. This is a story from Brazil, CNN. The argument started over a red card. It escalated when a referee fatally stabbed the player. It ended when the player's enraged family members stoned the referee to death and dismembered his body. You know, if you watch soccer games in countries like Brazil or almost any of the Islamic countries, but even in countries like Spain and Italy, you watch a soccer game and it's apparent that the fans are indeed fanatics. They have a religious zeal towards the game, as if they're personally identifying with the players, and if they lose, it's as if a part of their soul has been ripped away. So here's a referee. He called a foul during a soccer match. He showed the player, Abreu, a red card, which is the highest penalty. It translates to means you're being expelled. Go into expulsion from the game as a result of the foul. Now, Abreu, 30, who was 10 years older than the referee, wasn't going to take it, and he confronted the referee. Now, the altercation grew ugly, so the referee, 20 years old now, pulled out a knife. The referee was armed with a knife. He pulled out the knife once the 30-year-old player confronted him on the call and plunged the knife into the player's chest. And then the family of the player decided that, you know, the thing that we ought to do, the right thing to do here, is to go stone the referee, this 20-year-old man, to death, and then they dismembered his body, cutting it into pieces.
Yeah, not only did they get revenge, but then they like took it a whole step further. They were like, we got to dismember this guy. It makes no sense.
And then they videotaped the entire episode so that those who want to watch what happens with fanatics can. You know, one of the things that has, I'm going to say one, there is a second aspect to this that I'm witnessing in sports today, beyond fanaticism, beyond the fact that people are so lost, they're desperate for a connection, and they choose very often sports as their means of satiating that desperation for a relationship, and also that not knowing, having a clue who God is, not even having any idea of who he is or what he's offering, they will often elevate individuals to heroic status to superstar status. We see this as well. And that's one aspect of this. Another aspect of it is that as you watch sports today, I was watching a game last night. It was the Angels were playing the Boston Red Sox. And the umpire, I mean, he was clueless. He was... Josh Hamilton, for example, was batting. He's had a real tough time this year. Paid a bundle of money. You guys had a life of bad choices, alcohol abuse and cocaine addiction and the like. Hamilton was batting. He's had a tendency to chase after bad pitches, so he's batting like 20 points north of Mendoza, although he appears to have been awakening a bit here recently and is hitting a little better in clutch situations. He had a 3-2 count. That's 3 balls, 2 strikes. And the pitcher threw a pitch about a foot outside, but was low by about 6 inches and about a foot outside. I mean, we're not talking about close. And he got ready to toss his bat and run to first base. And the umpire, and you see this all the time in umpires, it's like, what right do you have to already determine that that was a ball? I'm going to call it a strike just to spite you. And he called it a strike. And it's, you see bad calls not only all the time, but that the umpire gets incensed that his judgment is being called into question. It seems to me, no matter what sport I watch, that the judgment of those officiating the game is deteriorating rapidly. And I think it is actually a symptom of our society as a whole. I suspect that the inability to exercise good judgment as an official in a sport is directly related to political correctness, where we have been taught not to exercise good judgment in life. Speaking of not exercising good judgment, when we recognize what happened in Egypt, you have a revolution begin in Tunisia, whereby a street peddler, doesn't like the abuse, the regulations that the secular government is imposing upon him, and he decides to set himself on fire. And as a result of him setting himself on fire because he doesn't like the regulations of his government and he's frustrated, doesn't know anything else to do, which was rather poor judgment, a number of Tunisians decide they're going to rebel against their secular dictator. And they do. And the result of that is they get an Islamic government, the Ennahda Party, which was the most fundamentalist Islamic party running for office. And so now Tunisia is an Islamic government. And then we witnessed in Egypt shortly after Barack Hussein Obama gave a speech at the at what is the birthplace of the Muslim Brotherhood, Al-Jahar University, the leading Islamic university for Sunnis in the world, telling the Muslims that, you know, they have a great religion and this is their time and that the future is theirs. They have had such a positive influence on the world. They rise up against Mubarak, who was a secular dictator. And the Muslim Brotherhood, which is the wellspring from which every Sunni terrorist organization on the planet has been created, all but Hezbollah, which is a Shia terrorist organization, came from the Muslim Brotherhood. Al-Qaeda, which is the most notorious, is a product of the Muslim Brotherhood. Hamas is a direct descendant of the Muslim Brotherhood. PLO, Yasser Arafat's Fatah, a direct descendant of the Muslim Brotherhood. The United States orchestrates with Secretary of State Hillary Rodham Clinton, her chief of staffs being very active in the Muslim Brotherhood. In fact, her mother being the leader in the Muslim Sisterhood to support subversive activities outside the Islamic world to embrace the Muslim Brotherhood. We enable the Muslim Brotherhood to come to power. They destroy what was left of Egypt's economy, and they write a constitution that is based solely on Islamic principles and Sharia. They win 2/3 of the vote. And then within a year of that time, you have the army decide, based upon millions of Christians and Copt Christians and liberals in Egypt marching in opposition at the one-year anniversary of the Islamic government, that they are going to exercise a military coup. The head of the military coup, General Sisi, is a fundamentalist Muslim, maybe as fundamentalist as was Morsi. And he tries to put window dressing on all of this by getting one of the conservative Islamic parties, the Noor Party, which was the Salafs, to embrace the removal of Morsi. And as a result of doing that and asking the people to accept, they weren't wanted them to accept El-Baradei as the prime minister. Now, can you imagine that? You've got in Iran the man most responsible for hoodwinking the West and allowing Iran to complete its nuclear bomb-making ambitions as the prime minister of Iran, and the man associated with the UN's nuclear watchdog agency, Al-Baradei, becoming prime minister of Egypt, the man who ran cover for the Iranian nuclear program for so many years. And them being head of the two most populous Islamic states in the Middle East. Well, anyway, the Noor Party decided, no, we're not going to play anymore because the Egyptian military murdered over 40 people last night. Cold blood. Just gunned them down in cold blood. And so now in Egypt, you have a raw, violent, murderous, against their own people, military government empowered once again. And the United States is dead silent. All the United States will say is that if you arrest Morsi or his Muslim Brotherhood associates, then we're going to withhold aid from you. and that Egypt ought to go back as quickly as possible to their elected government, and their elected government was Islamic. I mean, I understand that in Egypt, just as is in the case of Syria, there is no good side. Both sides are rotten to the core. We ought not be aiding or abetting or aligning ourselves with either side. General Sisi is a fundamentalist Muslim. The army of Egypt kills its own citizens. They're the ones that when a woman claimed to be raped, they abused the woman, the victim of rape, as opposed to prosecuting the rapists. That's the military of Egypt. They're rotten. And yet the United States supplies the money that they thrive off of, $1.3 billion a year. Morsi's regime was a rotten Islamic regime trying to impose Sharia law on Egypt, which would have sent it back to the Dark Ages. Would have caused every woman in Egypt to have to fear for her life. It would have caused the Copt Christians to be annihilated. And yet the United States wants to support the Islamic Brotherhood, the Muslim Brotherhood in all of this. Why don't we just disengage? Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm looking at an article that was just sent to me. One of the things that has struck me, based upon the crash of the airplane, this 777, into San Francisco airport, was that the head of the National Transportation Safety Board, at least the talking head in San Francisco that is briefing the media, is wholly unqualified for that position. It is a woman that appears to have received her position as a direct result of a political favor as opposed to expertise in the field. This quote from her this morning: "We're certainly looking at the crew and how they operated, how they were trained at their experience." How they were trained at their experience? I mean, come on. We're also looking at the aircraft. We're looking to see if the crew was using automation or was flying on autopilot. That's like saying, were you driving the car, or were you driving the car? I mean, were you using speed control, or were you using control for the speed? It is astonishing. Also, this article points out that it appears now that one of the two children that was killed was killed because they were run over by the San Francisco Fire Department. The San Francisco Fire Department, though, has been unwilling to respond. They wouldn't even respond to CNN to say, is there any truth to the story that the youngest child was actually run over at the hospital. They have acknowledged that her injuries were the result of having a tire crush her body. There weren't any tires on that airplane. So it is, once again, just frustrating to see how we are behaving today. Well, Barack Hussein Obama, speaking of frustrating, has only made one statement on Egypt, and this is really the crosshairs of his administration. This is where he went immediately after being elected to reset the discussion between America and the Islamic world. And look at the result of what has grown out of that. A civil war in Syria, giving Iraq to Iran, the rise of Hezbollah in Libya, the rise of Hamas in their aspirations over Israel. Look at what's happened in Tunisia with the replacement of a secular party by an Islamic party in Libya, by the replacement of a secular dictator with Islamic terrorists. In Egypt, with not only the replacement of a secular dictator with a Islamic regime, but now the Islamic regime being deposed so that they've returned back to a military dictatorship, but this time the military is being head being led by a Salafist fundamentalist Muslim? I mean, look at what has transpired. And all this man can say for his accountability. And mind you, with all the sequester where, you know, we couldn't have airplanes fly on time because sequester required us to have fewer FAA personnel in the control towers. So Mr. Obama wanted the people who actually participate in our economy, wanted them stung by the sequester. Well, he was able to justify spending tens of millions of dollars, if not $100 million, going off on a jaunt throughout Africa. And while he's on his jaunt throughout Africa, this man couldn't even bother to deal with the mess that he created in Egypt. It is astonishing, but here's his statement. Mr. Obama released a carefully worded statement. This was days ago, calling on the military to move, this is quote, move quickly and responsibly to return full authority back to a democratically elected civilian government as soon as possible. Well, a civilian government that was elected, they were the Muslim Brotherhood. So he wants to go back to an Islamic government. And then he said to avoid any arbitrary arrests of President Morsi or his supporters, who are also the Muslim Brotherhood. So what is it about this president and his absolute love, his fascination with, his deep-seated desire for Islam to subject people to Sharia law? Whose side is he on? And why has he not been impeached? I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. We'll return, turning our attention to Yahweh and his Torah and to the second of the 10 statements he etched in stone after the commercial break.